The U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority disbanded Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army completely. It then had to be rebuilt from the ground up. The new Iraqi army's training was disorganized, ad hoc, and scattered at best. Some Iraqi soldiers had almost no training. Officers often bribed or bought their way into their rank. Young enlisted Iraqi soldiers' primary goal was survival, not victory. Physically, they were weak. Most Iraqi soldiers were incapable of doing even a few push-ups or jumping jacks. Tactically, they were dangerous and unsound, regularly violating basic safety procedures. Worse, some of the Iraqi soldiers had questionable loyalty to the coalition and to the new government of Iraq. Some Sunni soldiers remained loyal to Saddam, but most Iraqi soldiers were Shiites, and many of these saw Muqtada al-Sadr, the fiery cleric hostile to Americans and closely allied with Iran, as a national hero. Every so often, reports surfaced of Iraqi soldiers who turned their weapons on their U.S. Army or Marine Corps advisors. With that knowledge, how could trust be built? In addition to poor training, the Iraqi soldiers were barely equipped for a camping trip, much less combat operations. Some wore sneakers or sandals. Their uniforms were a mix and match collection of military clothing in American, Soviet, or Middle Eastern camouflage. The variety of clothing made it hard to distinguish friend from foe, especially in an environment where the enemy also wore paramilitary uniforms and gear. Iraqi soldiers' web gear, or load-bearing equipment, consisted of tattered canvas Soviet-era chest rigs with AK-47 magazine pouches that often fell apart. The weapons they carried were a mix of rifles confiscated from insurgents, many of them poorly made Iraqi or Chinese copies of the AK-47. Most were in poor shape and far below the standards of the original Russian design. It was not uncommon to find the weapons rusted to the point where the sights could not be adjusted. Their technology generally stopped at their weapon. They had no night vision goggles, no lasers, no radios. In fact, very few even had a simple flashlight. Their body armor was ancient, with questionable effectiveness. Task Unit Bruiser was charged with getting our Iraqi soldiers equipped, organized, and most important, trained and ready to fight the insurgents who seemed to be increasingly effective against U.S. military forces. In less hostile areas of Iraq, this meant building training programs on secure bases and running Iraqi soldiers through basic soldiering skills and finally some advanced infantry tactics before taking them out on patrol in enemy territory. But this was Ramadi, the epicenter of the insurgency and the decisive battle for Al-Anbar province. There was fighting to be done, outposts to protect, and enemy fighters to capture and kill. To pull Iraqi soldiers from the battlefield for training beyond a day or two was simply impossible. Our mission as SEALs was to go into hostile territory with these ragtag Iraqi soldiers and fight against hardcore, insurgent Mujahideen fighters determined to kill as many of us as they could. Now, SEALs are known to run to the sound of the guns. But running to the sound of the guns is much easier when a SEAL is surrounded by other SEALs. When we know the man covering our six, or backside, is someone who has been through the same training, has the same gear, and speaks the same language. Someone we could trust. For a SEAL to put his life in the hands of someone he doesn't know, a person he has barely worked with, who is not well-trained, undisciplined, speaks a different language, and whose trustworthiness is doubtful, is asking a hell of a lot. In the SEAL teams, the bond of our brotherhood is our strongest weapon. If you take that away from us, we lose our most important quality as a team. When our SEALs and Task Unit Bruiser learned that they would be allowed to conduct combat operations only alongside Iraqi soldiers, they were livid and completely against the idea. We knew that the dangers in Ramadi from the enemy were already extremely high. There was no need to increase the risk to our force. Yet that is exactly what we were being directed to do. Even my initial reaction was hell no. It just wasn't worth the risk. Why would we go into combat without every possible advantage, much less a self-inflicted distinct disadvantage? I didn't believe that the mission made sense. I didn't believe it was smart. I didn't believe it would be successful. To imagine a firefight alongside Iraqi soldiers with such inferior training and questionable loyalty seemed outrageous, perhaps even suicidal. But as Task Unit Bruiser's commander, I knew my actions and mindset carried great weight among my troops. These were my orders, and for me to lead, I had to believe. So I kept my doubts to myself as I asked the simple question, why? Why would the U.S. military leadership on the ground in Iraq and back in America, from Baghdad to the Pentagon to the White House, task Navy SEALs, other special operations, and U.S. Army and Marine Corps units with such a high-risk mission? I had seen how difficult combat could be with the best people by my side. Why make it harder? I knew I had to adjust my perspective, to mentally step back from the immediate fight just outside the wire and think about this question from a strategic level, as if I were one of those generals in Baghdad or back at the Pentagon. Sure, they were far from the front lines, but certainly they had the same goal we did, to win. That led to another question. What was winning? It certainly wasn't winning in the traditional military sense of the word. There would be no surrender from this enemy we fought against. There would be no peace treaty signed. Winning here meant only that Iraq would become a relatively secure and stable country. So I asked myself, how can we prepare the Iraqi soldiers to handle security in their own country? They needed to start somewhere. If there wasn't time to train Iraqi soldiers off the battlefield in a secure environment on base, then they would have to learn by doing, through OJT, on-the-job training. If the Iraqis never reached a level of skill at which they could defend their country from terrorist insurgents, then who would defend it? The answer was all too clear. Us, the U.S. military. We would be stuck here securing their country for them for generations. The disparity between the capability of the poorly trained, ill-equipped, and unmotivated Iraqi soldiers and that of the determined, well-equipped, and highly effective insurgent fighters they were up against was gigantic. Virtually every time an American outpost in Ramadi was handed over to the control of Iraqi soldiers, insurgents attacked and overran their position, killing dozens of Iraqi troops and sometimes the U.S. Marine or Army advisors assigned to them. The Iraqi soldiers were no match for the insurgents. It would take generations of training to get the Iraqi soldiers to the level needed to overcome and defeat such an aggressive enemy. Even then, such lackluster soldiers would likely never be capable of fighting and defeating a serious adversary. For those of us on the front lines of this conflict, it was clear that there were many senior U.S. military officers who, far removed from direct interaction with Iraqi soldiers, did not understand the Iraqi army's true lack of capability. They were simply terrible, and no amount of training would make them excellent soldiers. But perhaps we could make them good enough. As I thought about this, I realized there was something that we, Task Unit Bruiser, and other U.S. and coalition forces could do. These Iraqi troops, or Jundis as they called themselves in Arabic, may never be good enough to take on a well-equipped and determined enemy. But they could be good enough to handle a less substantial enemy. We could ensure the current enemy fit into that category by reducing the insurgents' ability to wage war. In addition to building the Iraqi army's capability through training and combat advising on the battlefield, we, our SEALs and U.S. forces, would have to crush the insurgency and lower its capability to a point where Iraqi soldiers and police would at least have a chance to maintain a relative peace by themselves, a chance to win. In order to do that, our Task Unit Bruiser SEALs needed to get outside the wire, onto the battlefield, and inflict serious damage on insurgent fighters. But we couldn't operate unless our combat missions received approval through our chain of command. The SEAL task unit that had been in Ramadi for the months prior to our arrival had told us they had planned a number of combat operations that consisted of only SEALs, without Iraqi soldiers. Almost all of those operations had been denied approval. In order to receive that approval, I knew we must take Iraqi soldiers with us on every operation. They were our ticket to leave the base, push into enemy territory, and unleash fury upon the insurgents. With that, I understood. And I believed. Now I had to ensure that my troops understood and believed. I called for a meeting and pulled all the SEAL operators from Task Unit Bruiser together into the briefing room. "All right, fellas," I said. "You've heard the rumors. Every operation we conduct will include Iraqi soldiers. There were mutterings of obscenities and loud exhales of disgust. I repeated, "Every mission we undertake, we will fight alongside Jundis." The room cut loose again, this time with louder disagreement and curses. The consensus from our SEALs, the frontline troops who would execute our missions, was clear. This is garbage. I cut the not-so-subtle protest short. I understand. The battlefield here in Ramadi is dangerous. It's difficult. Why make it even harder by forcing us to fight alongside Iraqi soldiers? Damn right, nodded much of the room in agreement. Well, let me ask you something, I continued. If the Iraqi military can't get to a point where they can handle security in their own country, who is going to do it? The room fell silent. I drove home the point by restating the question. I say again, if the Iraqi military can't handle the security in this country, who is going to do it? I had their attention, and they knew the answer. But to ensure everyone clearly understood the strategic importance of why we were being directed to do this, I made it perfectly clear. If Iraqi soldiers can't do it, there is only one group that will. Us. If we don't get these guys up to speed, we will have this mission next year, and the year after, and the year after. The U.S. military will be stuck here for generations. It will be up to our sons and our sons' sons to secure Iraq. I could see that, although there was still resistance to the idea of working with Iraqi soldiers, they were beginning to see this mission from a strategic perspective. I continued, like you, I understand that no matter how much we train them, the Iraqi army will never come close to achieving the standards we set for ourselves. But we will help them get better, and there is something else we can do to help them. We will close with and destroy the enemy on the streets of Ramadi to reduce the insurgents' military capability and lower the level of violence. When the enemy is beaten, then the Iraqi army can take over security duties for themselves. I saw some heads nod in agreement. But to do that, I said, we have to get each mission, each operation, approved. And if we want our missions approved, we must have Iraqi soldiers with us on every operation. Does anyone not understand this? The room was quiet. Everyone understood. They didn't have to jump for joy at the thought of fighting alongside Iraqi soldiers on a dangerous battlefield. But they did have to understand why they were doing it, so that they could believe in the mission. Afterward, I spoke to my key leaders in greater detail about why this mission was important. Unlike the previous SEAL task unit, I told my officers and chiefs they were not to submit any concept of operations, or CONOPS, a document that lays out the basic idea of an operation for approval by higher headquarters, without Iraqi soldiers as part of our force. What about all the unilateral operations you did on your last deployment? Leif asked me. Didn't they make a difference? The other platoon commander and both platoon chiefs waited for my response. Yes, we did a whole lot of unilateral direct action missions in Iraq 2 years ago, I answered. And since that time, coalition forces across Iraq have continued to do them. But here are the facts. In the last 2 years, enemy attacks are up 300%. 300%. This place is on a downward spiral. We've got to do something different if we want to win. Every one of your operations will have Iraqi soldiers, I told them. These Iraqi soldiers are our means to do something different, our ticket to operate. We will get them up to speed. We will prepare them the best we can. We will fight alongside them, and we will crush the enemy until even the Iraqi army will be able to fight them on their own. Any other questions? There were no more questions. The most important question had been answered. Why? Once I analyzed the mission and understood for myself that critical piece of information, I could then believe in the mission. If I didn't believe in it, there's no way I could possibly convince SEALs in my task unit to believe in it. If I expressed doubts or openly questioned the wisdom of this plan in front of the troops, their derision toward the mission would increase exponentially. They would never believe in it. As a result, they would never commit to it, and it would fail. But once I understood and believed, I then passed that understanding and belief on, clearly and succinctly, to my troops, so that they believed in it themselves. When they understood why, they would commit to the mission, persevere through the inevitable challenges in store, and accomplish the task set before us. Most of the operators accepted my explanation. Not every member of Task Unit Bruiser was convinced immediately, we had to reinforce the importance of combat advising Iraqi soldiers continuously. Through the course of the deployment, our SEALs conducted every major operation with Iraqi soldiers. Often Iraqi soldiers did things that were stupid and dangerous. On one combat operation, an Iraqi soldier accidentally squeezed the trigger of his AK-47 rifle and blasted a dozen rounds of fully automatic fire into the floor next to the SEAL operator standing near him. The bullets missed some of our SEALs by inches. On another operation, Leif and his SEAL combat advisors had to rip the rifles out of the hands of Iraqi soldiers who, while under fire, ran from the enemy contact while shooting their AK-47s backward over their heads, with other SEALs and Iraqi soldiers downrange from them. Incredibly foolish. Another time, Iraqi soldiers on patrol with our SEALs were engaged by enemy fighters. An Iraqi soldier was hit, and his comrades abandoned him in the street and ran for cover. Two SEALs had to run through a hailstorm of enemy fire across an open street, what we called a Medal of Honor run, to retrieve the wounded Iraqi soldier and drag him to cover while bullets impacted all around them. The Iraqi soldiers frustrated the hell out of our SEALs, who trained and fought alongside them. But they also proved to be useful in ways we hadn't anticipated. A SEAL breacher might use a sledgehammer or explosive charge to open a gate, an effective method, though extremely loud, which let everyone in the neighborhood know we were there. Our Iraqi soldiers knew how the doors and gates were secured and would quietly pop them open by hand with little effort. They could also tell the bad guys from the good. To our American eyes, when unarmed enemy fighters were hiding among the civilian populace, we often couldn't tell the difference. But our Iraqi soldiers could discern dress, mannerisms, and Arabic accents that were different from that of the local populace. Their local and cultural knowledge were advantageous in helping us better understand and identify the enemy. Over the next 6 months, we took Iraqi soldiers right into the thick of some of the biggest battles for the city of Al Ramadi. Several of them were killed in action. Others were wounded. Despite the grumblings from Task Unit Bruiser, a certain base level of camaraderie formed between our SEALs and their Iraqi counterparts through blood, sweat, and tears of difficult combat operations. Through the success of the U.S. Army's 1st Armored Division, Ready 1st Brigade combat teams, seize, clear, hold, build strategy, enemy fighters were forced out of their former safe havens within Ramadi. Because we included Iraqi soldiers with us on every operation, our chain of command approved all our plans to push deep into dangerous enemy territory in support of this strategy. That enabled us to hammer enemy fighters with deadly effect, making those areas a little safer for the U.S. soldiers and Marines that built permanent combat outposts and lived and patrolled out of them, forcing the insurgents out of their former strongholds. As a result, the local people ceased passive support of the insurgents and instead switched sides to support U.S. and Iraqi forces. Over time, the level of violence decreased dramatically, as did the insurgents' military capability. By the end of our deployment, the area was secure enough to enable our Iraqi army units to begin operations under their own command and control, patrolling into the city, engaging the enemy, and capturing or killing insurgents. That portion of the mission was a success by any measure. Principle. In order to convince and inspire others to follow and accomplish a mission, a leader must be a true believer in the mission. Even when others doubt and question the amount of risk, asking, "Is it worth it?" the leader must believe in the greater cause. If a leader does not believe, he or she will not take the risks required to overcome the inevitable challenges necessary to win. And they will not be able to convince others, especially the frontline troops, who must execute the mission to do so. Leaders must always operate with the understanding that they are part of something greater than themselves and their own personal interests. They must impart this understanding to their teams down to the tactical level operators on the ground. Far more important than training or equipment, a resolute belief in the mission is critical for any team or organization to win and achieve big results. In many cases, the leader must align his thoughts and visions to that of the mission. Once a leader believes in the mission, that belief shines through to those below and above in the chain of command. Actions and words reflect belief with a clear confidence and self-assuredness that is not possible when belief is in doubt. The challenge comes when that alignment isn't explicitly clear. When a leader's confidence breaks, Those who are supposed to follow him or her see this and begin to question their own belief in the mission. Every leader must be able to detach himself from the immediate tactical mission and understand how it fits into strategic goals. When leaders receive an order that they themselves question and do not understand, they must ask the question, why? Why are we being asked to do this? Those leaders must take a step back, deconstruct the situation, analyze the strategic picture, and then come to a conclusion. If they cannot determine a satisfactory answer themselves, they must ask questions up the chain of command until they understand why. If frontline leaders and troops understand why, they can move forward, fully believing in what they are doing. It is likewise incumbent on senior leaders to take the time to explain and answer the questions of their junior leaders so that they too can understand why and believe. Whether in the ranks of military units or companies and corporations, the frontline troops never have as clear an understanding of the strategic picture as senior leaders might anticipate. It is critical that those senior leaders impart a general understanding of that strategic knowledge, the why, to their troops. In any organization, goals must always be in alignment. If goals aren't aligned at some level, this issue must be addressed and rectified. In business, just as in the military, no senior executive team would knowingly choose a course of action or issue an order that would purposely result in failure. But a subordinate may not understand a certain strategy and thus not believe in it. Junior leaders must ask questions and also provide feedback up the chain so that senior leaders can fully understand the ramifications of how strategic plans affect execution on the ground. Belief in the mission ties in with the fourth law of combat, decentralized command, Chapter 8. The leader must explain not just what to do, but why. It is the responsibility of the subordinate leader to reach out and ask if they do not understand. Only when leaders at all levels understand and believe in the mission can they pass that understanding and belief to their teams so that they can persevere through challenges, execute, and win. Application to business. "This new compensation plan is terrible," said one of the mid-level managers. "It will drive our best salespeople away." The rest of the class agreed. Toward the end of a short leadership development program for the company's mid-level managers, my discussions with the class had revealed a major issue that created stress and fragmentation among the ranks of the company. Corporate leadership had recently announced a new compensation structure for their sales force. The new plan substantially reduced compensation, especially for low-producing salespeople. "What's the issue?" I asked the group. "It's hard enough to keep salespeople here. This doesn't help," one manager responded. "They don't get how hard it is in this market," said another, referring to corporate senior leadership. "This new compensation plan will push people to our competitors." "Some of my folks have already heard rumors about it. They don't like it at all. And I can't convince them otherwise. I don't believe in it myself," another responded. I asked them all a simple question, why? "Why what?" one of the managers responded. "Why is your leadership making this change?" I asked. "Hell if I know," one manager stated emphatically, which brought laughs from the group. I smiled and nodded. Then I asked again, "Okay, but why do you think they are implementing this plan? Do you think they want to push your best salespeople out the door? Do they want those salespeople to go to your competitors? Do you think they actually want the company to lose money and fail?" The room was quiet. The managers, most of whom respected their bosses and maintained good relationships with the company's corporate leadership, knew their leaders were smart, experienced, and committed to the success of the company. The problem was that no one could understand why this new plan had been implemented. "Has anyone asked?" I questioned them. The room fell silent. Finally, the class clown blurted it out, "I'm not asking. I like my job." Laughter erupted from the room. I smiled and settled them down. "Understandable," I replied. "So the CEO, is she unreasonable? Would she actually fire someone for asking the question?" The group of managers mumbled, "No." "What is it then?" I asked. Finally, one of the more senior managers spoke up with a serious answer. "I'd feel pretty stupid asking. Our CEO is smart and has a lot of experience. She gets this business." "Okay," I shot back. "So then you're all just scared to look stupid?" Heads nodded in a universal yes. I nodded as well, now more fully understanding the issue. No one wants to look stupid, especially in front of the boss. Let me ask you this, I continued. When you can't explain the reason behind this new compensation plan to your sales force, how does that make you look? Stupid and scared, the class clown responded. Exactly, I shot back in jest, but I knew a simple, easy way to solve the problem had been uncovered. That afternoon, I swung by the CEO's office. She was meeting with the company's president of sales. How's the workshop going? The CEO inquired. It's going pretty well, I said. You have a solid crew of managers. Absolutely. They are a great group, replied the CEO. How is your relationship with them? I asked. Oh, I think it's very strong with most of them. Some of the newer ones I don't know all that well yet, but as a whole, I have a good relationship with our managers, the CEO answered. Do they ever confront you on anything or ask questions? I asked. The CEO thought for a few seconds. Not really, she acknowledged. I think they get the business, and I think they know what we are trying to do. So there really isn't much that they would need to confront me on. I've been in this game a long time. I wouldn't be here today if I didn't know what was going on. They know that, and I think they respect that. Experience counts for a lot in this business. But I think if they had an issue, they would certainly bring it up to me. A common misperception among military leaders or corporate senior executives, this was an example of a boss who didn't fully comprehend the weight of her position. In her mind, she was fairly laid back, open to questions, comments, and suggestions from people. She talked about maintaining an open-door policy. But in the minds of her sales managers, she was still the boss, experienced, smart, and most important, powerful. That position demanded a high level of reverence, so high, in fact, that for an employee to question her ideas seemed disrespectful. None of them were comfortable questioning her, even though none of the mid-level managers actually worried about losing their jobs because they had asked a question. But they were certainly worried about looking bad in front of the boss. I'm not sure they are as comfortable confronting you or opening up to you as you think, I stated bluntly. Really? The CEO asked with a slightly puzzled face. Let me give you an example that came up today, I replied. The new sales compensation plan. What about it? Don't they like it? The CEO asked with surprise. It's not that they don't like it, I answered. I don't think they get it. Don't get it? The plan isn't really that complex. In fact, it's simple, said the CEO, preparing to give me a quick explanation. It's not that they don't get what the plan is. You're right, it's simple. It reduces overall compensation for sales staff, especially for low producers. Exactly. What's the issue with that? The CEO said. She was right. Even I, without experience in this particular field, had no trouble understanding the basic concept of this new compensation plan. The issue is not that they don't understand the plan, but that they don't understand why the plan is being implemented. They don't believe in it. They think the plan will drive away good salespeople, who will look for and possibly find better compensation plans at your competitors, I explained. The CEO now got a little defensive. Then they clearly don't understand what I am doing with the business, she stated. When we cut compensation, especially on the low-producing salespeople, that savings reduces cost. When I reduce cost for the salespeople, it reduces our overhead. With our overhead reduced, I can lower the price of our products. That will allow our bigger producers to bring in even more business. Sure, the new compensation plan is punitive toward our bottom people, but those bottom people really don't move the needle in our business. If some of them leave, it won't impact our business. In fact, it will allow some of our better producers to expand into those accounts and increase sales. So there is an opportunity for our sales force to do even better. That makes a lot of sense, I replied. It absolutely does, said the CEO. She explained how she had made this move before in a tough market. It almost always helps. It might reduce the overall size of our sales force, but it will increase our volume in the long run. A smaller, more effective sales force also reduces overhead, with lower healthcare costs, fewer desks, fewer computers to buy, greater efficiency. It's a win-win. That sounds brilliant. There's only one problem with it, I said. What's that? Said the CEO, incredulous. Your mid-level managers don't understand those points. They don't understand why. And so they don't believe in the strategy. If they don't believe, neither will your sales force. If this plan rolls out and those executing it don't believe in it, your plan is far more likely to fail. So what can I do to make them believe? Asked the CEO. It's easy, I explained. Just tell them why. The CEO finally understood what she needed to do. For my training with the mid-level managers the next day, the CEO made an appearance and kicked things off with a short presentation. "Good morning, everyone," she began. "Jocko pointed out to me that you all had some issues with the new compensation plan. What don't you like?" After a few moments of silence, one of the more senior managers finally mustered the courage to speak up. "Cutting into our sales team's take-home pay hurts," said the manager. "It may drive some of them elsewhere, and that could hurt us in the long run." The CEO smiled. She explained the details of the strategy behind the plan: the increased volume, the reduced overhead, the greater capture of existing accounts when handled by higher-producing salespeople. The managers quickly saw the connection and understood the benefits of the plan. "Does anyone have any questions?" the CEO finished. No one spoke up. "Seriously, does anyone have any questions? Don't be afraid to ask. I obviously didn't make this clear to you. And unfortunately, none of you asked," she jabbed. "No, I think we get it now," one of the managers replied. "Do you think you can explain it to your sales force in a manner that they will understand?" asked the CEO. "I do," a manager answered. "But I still think some of the low producers will be upset." "I'm sure some of them will be," the CEO replied. "As I said, that's part of the strategy here. The ones I want you to focus on here are the big producers and those that you think have the potential to become big producers. I have done this before. We will get results. Anyone else have anything?" The room, now loosened up by the straight-shooting conversation with the CEO, relaxed and broke into some small talk before the CEO went on her way. The class continued. "What do you think?" I asked the class. "That is exactly what we needed," said one manager. "Now I get it," remarked another. "I wish we would have known that all along," a third manager stated. "Let me ask you another question. Who is to blame for the CEO not explaining this to you in more detail?" I asked. The managers in the room remained silent. They knew the answer and nodded as they acknowledged a topic that I had covered in detail earlier. "That's right," I said. "You. That's what extreme ownership is all about. If you don't understand or believe in the decisions coming down from your leadership, it is up to you to ask questions until you understand how and why those decisions are being made. Not knowing why prohibits you from believing in the mission. When you are in a leadership position, that is a recipe for failure, and it is unacceptable. As a leader, you must believe." "But the boss should have explained this to us, right?" one manager asked. "Absolutely. I explained that to her. And sure enough, she came down here and did just that. But she's not a mind reader. The CEO can't predict what you won't get or understand. She's not perfect. None of us are. Things are going to slip through the cracks from time to time. It happens. I made all kinds of mistakes when I led SEALs. Often, my subordinate leadership would pick up the slack for me. And they wouldn't hold it against me, nor did I think they were infringing on my leadership turf. On the contrary, I would thank them for covering me. Leadership isn't one person leading a team. It's a group of leaders working together up and down the chain of command to lead. If you are on your own, I don't care how good you are, you won't be able to handle it." "So we let the boss down when we didn't ask questions and communicate with her," said one of the quieter managers in the back of the room. "Yes, you did," I confirmed. "People talk about leadership requiring courage. This is exactly one of those situations. It takes courage to go to the CEO's office, knock on her door, and explain that you don't understand the strategy behind her decisions. You might feel stupid, but you will feel far worse trying to explain to your team a mission or strategy that you don't understand or believe in yourself. And, as you pointed out, you are letting the boss down because she will never know that her guidance is not being promulgated properly through the ranks. If you don't ask questions so you can understand and believe the mission, you are failing as a leader and you are failing your team. So if you ever get a task or guidance or a mission that you don't believe in, don't just sit back and accept it. Ask questions until you understand why, so you can believe in what you are doing and you can pass that information down the chain to your team with confidence so that they can get out and execute the mission. That is leadership. Chapter 4. Check the Ego. Jocko Willink. Camp Corregidor, Ramadi, Iraq. Welcome to Ramadi. Enemy tracer rounds were zipping overhead as I raced up the stairs, to the third-story rooftop of our Tactical Operations Center, or TOC, building. Our camp was under attack. I hadn't even had time to fasten my body armor. When the shooting started, I grabbed my helmet and rifle, slung my load-bearing equipment over my shoulders, and headed for the roof. SEALs were arriving by the dozen, some in flip-flops with only shorts and t-shirts under their body armor, but helmets on and weapons at the ready. Just across the river, in the darkness, enemy fighters had unleashed heavy volleys of machine gun fire on two separate U.S. outposts, and the American soldiers were returning fire with a vengeance. The bright glow of tracer fire was evident in both directions. Another group of enemy fighters had engaged our camp and were hammering our TOC building with gunfire from the far bank of the Euphrates River. But they hadn't counted on the response. Within minutes, every Navy SEAL in Task Unit Bruiser and several of our non-SEAL support personnel were on the rooftop shooting back. Some SEALs had brought their M4 rifles, other M79 40mm grenade launchers, others their Mark 48 and Mark 46 belt-fed machine guns. We unleashed incredible volleys of fire back at the enemy fighters' muzzle flashes. I directed an M79 gunner to put some 40mm illumination rounds up so we could better identify our targets. Leif was on the rooftop right next to me, shooting and directing fire. The SEAL just behind him unloaded two full 100-round belts through his machine gun, spewing spent shell casings across the rooftop that bounced with a metallic clink. Everybody was shooting, having a hell of a time. There was much laughter as guys unloaded what was clearly a ridiculous amount of gunfire at the enemy. Soon, the enemy fighters were either dead or retreating, and their attack subsided. The SEAL machine gunner looked around with a smile. "This is my third deployment to Iraq," said the SEAL machine gunner excitedly, "and that's the first time I've ever fired my machine gun in combat." It was his first day on the ground in Ramadi. A few of us had been here for a week, including Leif, some of the other key leaders, and me, but most of Task Unit Bruiser's SEALs had arrived only that day. As much fun as we had shooting from the rooftop, this was a wake-up call for everyone in Task Unit Bruiser. This was Ramadi, a total war zone and the most violent place in Iraq. For those of us who had deployed to Iraq previously, it was a realization that this time would be different and a lot more dangerous. Welcome to Ramadi. Throughout 2005 and 2006, the vast and volatile Al-Anbar province was the most dangerous place in Iraq, accounting for the majority of U.S. casualties in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Of all the places in Anbar, the city of Ramadi was the most deadly. Located on the Euphrates River, Ramadi, with 400,000 residents, was the capital of Anbar province and the epicenter of the violent Sunni insurgency. The city was strewn with rubble pile buildings, burned out hulks of twisted metal that had once been vehicles, and walls marred by bullet holes. Giant bomb craters from improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, dotted the main roads through town. Thousands of heavily armed Sunni insurgent fighters loyal to Al-Qaeda in Iraq controlled some two-thirds of the geographic area of the city. U.S. forces couldn't even begin to penetrate these areas without sustaining massive casualties. Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed the city as the capital of their caliphate. Valiant U.S. Army soldiers and Marines ran convoys and patrols along the deadly, heavily IED'd roads. They conducted cordon and search operations into enemy territory and engaged in fierce fighting. Most of the several thousand U.S. troops in Ramadi were located on large secure bases outside the city itself. But along the main road through the city, a string of isolated U.S. Marine and Army outposts were constantly under attack. The level of determination and sophistication from insurgent fighters in Ramadi was alarming, far beyond what any of us in Task Unit Bruiser had seen on previous deployments. Several times a week, groups of 20 or 30 well-armed enemy fighters launched hellacious attacks on U.S. forces. These were well-coordinated, complex attacks executed simultaneously on multiple U.S. outposts, separated by several kilometers. They were hardcore Muj. Many enemy attacks followed a similar pattern. Each began with a sudden barrage of accurate, devastating machine gun fire from multiple directions, which hammered the American sentry posts and forced those on guard to take cover. Then, while soldiers or Marines were hunkered down, deadly RPG-7 shoulder-fired rockets were launched in rapid succession, impacting with violent noise and lethal shrapnel. Next, mortars, fired from some distance away, rained down inside the walls of the coalition compound, often impacting with alarming accuracy. All of this was done in an effort to take out the sentries, or force them to keep their heads down long enough so they couldn't return fire, while the enemy launched their final and most devastating weapon, the VBIED suicide bomber, driving a large truck or vehicle filled with several thousand pounds of explosives. If the truck made it past the concrete barriers, past the Marine or Army sentries that would engage them, and inside the compound, the results would be catastrophic. As deadly as the most powerful U.S. Tomahawk missile launched from a Navy warship, or Joint Direct Attack Munition, JDAM, guided bomb, dropped from U.S. aircraft.